to Literature Done Juicy, a show that explores books in the juiciest way possible. My name's Jade, and in this season, we're exploring novels which feature lost protagonists. This is episode 4 of our second season, and today we'll be discussing the Aussie novel Westgirls by Laura Elizabeth Woollett. I actually published my review for Westgirls only last week over at Goodreads, so if you're interested, I've left a link below for you to go check it out in the show notes. So today, what are we going to be talking about? The topics are going to range from racial passing, that's a very big one, as well as pretty privilege, the modelling world, and nostalgia. This Aussie contemporary hits big with the topics, and it hits them with a very dry, sarcastic type of humour, which I'm all about. So let's get into the characters and plot of the novel, and this is probably going to be a pretty basic rundown, but I just want to give you the gist of what this book is about. So the main character is a girl called Luna Lewis, who ascends onto the global modeling stage under the name Luna Lou, and she's actually passing herself off as half Asian, although she's actually of white heritage, so her parents are Maltese and Welsh. She only narrates a few of the stories within this novel, as the format of the novel is in a short story form. So we hear from multiple perspectives and time periods, but they're all linked in some way, shape, or form to Luna. Some other characters that we hear from include a girl called Ricky, who is a white South African who comes from a very rich family and falls in love with an Indigenous boy. And then there's also Caitlin, or CB as she's referred to, and she's actually one of the catty members of The Blondes, who introduces Luna to a modeling agency and they become friends. So that's just a couple of the many perspectives that you can read within the novel. The setting itself is predominantly in a public high school in Perth, which is a mash of different classes and races within the school. There is one scene where a student called Penelope, who is poor and is Muslim, she's working at Subway after school, and then a fellow classmate, Ashley, who is part of the popular Blondes group, comes in and she's driven in by her dad, who owns a Land Rover. So there's this juxtaposition of different races and classes and how their hierarchy is set within the public school setting. The popular Blondes within this school are rich, pretty white girls who are, you all guessed it, Blonde, and then the rest of the students who aren't popular, who Luna originally, you know, sits with and hangs out with, are a more diverse group, and also they're being marginalized because of these diverse looks, and then also because of where they sit in terms of the class system. So their parents are poorer, whereas the parents of the blonde girls are richer and come from higher incomes. This is all then flipped on its head when Luna, who was originally a part of the marginalized group due to her unorthodox looks, is chosen to become a model, and then she's a figure of jealousy for the Blondes group, which then in turn allows her to join the popular group within the school. This irony is noticed by Luna's Indonesian stepmother, who actually finds it hilarious that Luna is taking a Chinese last name, so Luna Lu, and she's taking this name to move herself up in the world. Although both groups are divided by both wealth and ethnicity, they do have one belief in common, and they all believe that prettiness equals success. Pretty privilege is a topic that I briefly covered in a previous episode where I talked about American Psycho, and I actually spoke about how attractiveness actually leads people to trust you more. So the hotter you are, the more that people believe they can trust you. Whether or not that's the case is, you know, obviously up to debate. But does it allow you to be more successful? And apparently, yes, it does. And this has been shown in countless studies. So what exactly is pretty privilege? Well, it's the idea that attractive people often experience certain advantages in life that others might not. And it can manifest in various ways, such as career opportunities, social interactions, and overall well-being. Pretty privilege is essentially what CB and the Blondes experience within Westgirls. And then Luna at the start of the novel and her friends, who are in the minority group, do not experience this pretty privilege. CB also finds it's easy to become entangled in romantic relationships. She dates people who are like football douchebags who treat her terribly, which shows that even though she's at first treated more favorably, it's shallower people that are drawn to her because they only see her looks and not her personality. Studies have shown that attractive individuals are often perceived as more competent, friendly, and, like I've said previously, more trustworthy. Now, that's not to say that being beautiful guarantees success, but it does open doors and opportunities that might not have been readily available to other people. A study in 1998 by Matthew Mulford and colleagues, which was entitled Physical Attractiveness, Opportunity and Success in Everyday Exchange, found that subjects were more likely to cooperate with someone who they find attractive. It also found that both men and women who rated themselves as highly attractive were more likely to cooperate with others that they also found attractive. Mulford's study is using a group of people who rate themselves pretty highly on the physical scale, and the same can be said for the group of blondes within Westgirls. They all feel like they are beautiful as a collective, and they associate with only other pretty people. Another study, which was conducted in 2006 by Robert A. Barron and colleagues, which was entitled Exporting Social Psychology, Effects of Attractiveness on Perception of Entrepreneurs, Their Ideas for New Products, and Their Financial Success, found that entrepreneurs and their products were rated more favorably if they were attractive, tying financial success with attractiveness. This kind of marketing is actually done by the models within Westgirls themselves, as businesses use attractive people to sell their products, thus making their products more appealing. In Westgirls, the focus on pretty as an end goal appears to be predominantly shared by the girls, not the boys, which is scattered within the story. And of course, there are some studies which explain why this is. There is one particular study which was conducted in 2006 by Outi Sapila and Jani Arola, which was entitled Physical Attractiveness, Who Believes It Is a Ticket to Success? And this study found that it was women more so than men that believe attractiveness contributes to success. However, in the middle class, both men and women recognize the significance of physical attractiveness, which is believed to enable the middle class to differentiate themselves from the lower class. Within the narrative of Westgirls, the fixation on physical attractiveness is exacerbated by the intersecting factors of both wealth and race. The blondes and Luna strive to stand out in terms of attractiveness as a means of differentiating themselves from what they perceive as the lower class, which comprises of the economically disadvantaged and ethnically diverse cohort within their school. Studies such as these demonstrate why the popular girls in high school are usually the pretty ones and not the ones which are achieving well academically. But it is noteworthy that Luna challenges this pattern by passing as a race other than white, suggesting the complexities and nuances associated with beauty and privilege. Beauty standards vary from culture to culture and they can be quite subjective. What is considered attractive in one society might not be the same in another. So pretty privilege is a complex interplay between individual perceptions and then also societal norms. Like I've said previously, Luna is passing as someone with Asian heritage, even though she is a white European Australian. This occurs when a casting agent guesses her race and she fails to correct them, resulting in Luna Lu being born. And they also concoct a story that she was discovered in a fish market to make her appear even more Asian. When I was looking at research that has been conducted on passing, it was all focused on people who were black, who were passing as white, and then how that's impacted them. There was little studies on biracial Asians passing and basically nil literature on purely white people passing as another race. I seriously looked for hours and came up with basically zilch in terms of finding studies on white people choosing to pass as another race. However, I obviously did find some extreme examples, which I am definitely going to talk about, but let's get through some of the definitions and academic stuff first. The history of passing is a complex and deeply rooted aspect of American history, and passing refers to the act of an individual from one racial or ethnic group presenting themselves as a member of another group, often by concealing their true identity. So in 1882, the United States passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which was in place for 10 years, meaning that no Chinese immigrants could enter the states. This same act was then made permanent in 1902, and it wasn't appealed until World War II when China became an ally of the US. So for Chinese migrants to enter the United States, they would pass as Mexican to enter via the then more lenient Mexican-US border. And this was a form of passing which was occurring around the same time of African Americans passing as white due to the Jim Crow laws. So the Jim Crow laws were introduced in the late 19th century and remained in place until 1965. And it was a law which enabled forced segregation of African Americans and white Americans and also banned them from public services and voting. So although I couldn't find many studies on white people passing as other races, I did find one which focuses on biracial Asians and passing. And it was published in 2015, written by Natasha Gardenio Black, and entitled Exploring the Concept of Passing in Biracial Asian White College Students. Black found that despite being one of the largest and most rapidly growing subsets of multiracial population, psychological research on Asian white biracial identity is sparse. I hear, because I was looking for ages and there was nothing. So in this study, they found that this cohort endorsed a malleable identity which shifted between their environmental context. It was found that they easily passed as either white or Asian and then did so depending on the circumstance to achieve social or occupational gains. So they basically picked and choose what they wanted to pass as and found it to be an advantage to them. Now, in Westgirls, Luna is passing as Asian to gain an advantage, even though she isn't actually Asian. And there's not really many examples I could find in popular culture where this was happening, except for like the really racist examples in Hollywood back in the day, where white actors would play Asian characters. One that I've actually personally seen would be when Mickey Rooney plays a Japanese character called Yunioshi in the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's. However, I do believe in the director's commentary, the director says that they're remorseful for hiring a white person instead of a Japanese person to play the role. So other than these Hollywood examples, there is one really extreme example where a man has recently tried to become transracial using plastic surgery to attempt to turn into a Korean. Let's get into the cook stuff and talk about Ollie London. Ollie London's transformation journey is a hotbed of controversy as it has been perceived by many as deeply problematic. He's definitely mentally unwell. So he was born in the United Kingdom and he underwent multiple plastic surgeries to resemble what he believed was his true self. And his true self is apparently K-pop star Jimin from South Korea. His reasoning was that he always felt a profound connection with Korea and he believed that his soul was actually a Korean soul. He's gone under the knife around 32 times in the past 10 years for elective surgeries, and these surgeries were to obviously transform himself into the Korean pop star, but he also did a couple of surgeries to transition into a woman and then detransitioned. So he's paid over a whopping $200,000 for his surgeries. Ollie's journey into Korean identity involved a series of drastic cosmetic procedures, from rhinoplasty to mimic East Asian facial features to a silicone chin and cheek fillers, all with the aim of emulating his idealized K-pop image. However, in 2021, he publicly apologized in a YouTube video for trying to emulate Jimin. In early 2022, he then announced that he was transitioning into a woman, but then later, the very same year, announced that he was detransitioning and would be undergoing no further surgeries because he found religion, and now he is also anti-trans. He's definitely got a lot of identity issues, and I actually did find a study which focused on Ollie London, and it was written by Azifa Uditya and Yasmin Annabelle Penjaitan, and I'm sorry if I mispronounce those names, and it was entitled Gender and Identity Subversion in Ollie London's Plastic is Fantastic, and it was published in 2022 and uses Fairclough's three-dimensional theory as its framework. This framework stresses that every form of communication has three dimensions. Number one, it is a text, so image, speed, writing, or a combination of these. Number two, it can be a discursive practice involving the consumption and production of the text. So all of those things I just listed. And then also number three, that it can be the social practice. So using this framework and then Ollie London's music video, Plastic is Fantastic, which is the most cringe thing I've ever seen, and yes, I've linked it down below for you. The study found that Ollie London was engaging in behaviors and activities that deviate from the traditional expectations, and he tries to connect the Korean identity by using Korean language, fashion, and music, and also having an androgynous appearance. And it was also found that this identity was linked to social media and media reactions. The controversy and reactions were validating Aldi London's Korean identity. This form of validation is also seen through Luna Lu as a character. Although her behavior is problematic, it is nowhere near as messed up as Aldi London. But Luna gets continuous validation for her passing through compliments from fellow students, signing a modeling contract, the money and fame she gains through her modeling passing as an Asian mixed race woman, and then also her lack of consequences for her behavior in doing so. So how is Luna Lu so successful, and is it a success that could potentially be realistic in the real world? On a global scale, high fashion modeling has pretty similar standards across the board. They have to be tall, usually over 172 centimeters tall. They have to be slim, with a waist slimmer than the breasts and the bum. And they also have to have the right look, which is on trend. In Asia, there are slightly different standards. Height matters, but just not as much. For instance, there's a prevalent Japanese model called Lena Fuji, and she's only 160 centimeters tall, which would make her unable to model in the Western world. And this is actually found because the height average within these countries are lower than in the West. However, most modeling companies and people that are, you know, searching for models still prefer taller models. So although there are slight differences, as a whole, it's pretty much the same across the board. Also, white models within the East are quite prevalent, and Asian brands do tend to employ white or mixed race foreigners, especially in countries such as Japan, India, South Korea, China, and Singapore. And some countries such as Japan do have a huge market for mixed race people, and they've actually coined a term for it called heifu. This is definitely a market where Luna would have thrived, and this is due to the fact that racial ambiguity is popular among marketers because they are relatable to both foreigners and then also the local people. So in Japan, heifu has been said to be attractive since the Taisho era, which began in 1912. This is because in a newspaper article at the time, a heifu actor was described as an exotic beauty. The visibility of heifu increased in the post-war era due to Western soldiers having children with Japanese women. And Luna was actually described by a friend's dad as looking like a Oiga movie star. So basically describing her as looking like a Chinese actress, and specifically one which he was probably referencing would be Dilraba Dilmurat. So give her a Google, because that's basically what Luna Lu is being described as looking like and passing as. In 2007, Julie Matthews wrote a paper entitled Eurasian Persuasion, and the first line within her abstract simply says, Eurasians are in. Matthews found that in Asia, and also at the time increasingly in the West, Eurasian or heifu models had higher aesthetic appeal than most other races. And she ties in this phenomena with post-colonial practices and believes that mixed race models will help in creating a transcultural future. So Matthews believes that mixed race models erase the other that can be attributed to races different than your own. Due to connecting with more people, the product that the models are promoting also attracts more customers globally. Now, this is all well and good and great news for mixed race models or Eurasian models. However, the issue lies in the fact that Luna is pretending to be Eurasian. Her actions are dishonest and deceptive. She could still use her ambiguous look and then not label herself as Chinese. She would probably still find success in both the Western and Eastern markets because her aesthetics would not have changed. She'd still look the same. She just wouldn't have labeled herself as half Chinese. Her story that was concocted by the modeling agency really just perpetuates stereotypes, and her cultural appropriation allows for her to gain money and clout, yet also could have potentially taken away opportunities from actual mixed race models. And this rings very true to me. People like Kendall Jenner, who can't walk a catwalk to save their life, yet they get chosen due to their money and influence over other models, and these models are missing out because this other person has been chosen even though they don't really have that much of a legitimate claim to the spot that they have taken. So we've spoken about racial passing and modeling standards, but what about products that they're actually trying to sell and how nostalgia can be an excellent tool to sell said products? It is even a tool which is used to kind of suck you in within the novel West Girls itself. So let's start with a little history around nostalgia. It was originally believed to be a condition that would result in death, which I actually didn't know about. So first coined by Johannes Hofer in 1688, he observed that people living far away from home, usually soldiers that were sent away to war, would experience a psychological reaction which could become so severe that they died as a result, and the deaths themselves would usually be from suicide or self-neglect. He named this reaction nostalgia using the Greek word nostos, which means returning to a native area, and algos, which means pain or grief. He believed nostalgia was a quote-unquote sympathetic afflicted imagination caused by a continuous vibration of animal spirits. As time went by and we walked into a more modern world of the 1900s, the symptoms of the soldiers were recognized as PTSD, anxiety, and schizophrenia, not nostalgia. Then over time, the term evolved to become associated with a fondness of the past without a negative psychological reaction. Nostalgia has now become a powerful tool for advertising, and there have been several studies conducted on the strengths of utilizing nostalgia within marketing and advertising. And this technique is also used within Westgirls as well. Why is nostalgia successful in selling products, and why is it a tool used within writing? A paper written in 2012 entitled An Involvement Explanation for Nostalgia Advertising Effects, which was authored by Darrell Muehling and Vincent Pascal, found that personal nostalgia-themed ads, which means advertisements that elicit a yearning from a lived past, would be far more successful than both a non-nostalgic ad and a historically nostalgic ad. And when I say historical, it means that there is a yearning for the distant past, but this past hasn't been experienced by the consumer themselves. Also to note is historical nostalgic ads did perform better than the non-nostalgic ads. So nostalgia for the win. Another study published by Alison Shields and Jennifer Johnson in 2016, entitled Childhood Brand Nostalgia, A New Conceptualization and Scale Development, used existing literature to provide a framework for better understanding the phenomena of childhood to adult nostalgia and their relationships to brands. And the scale found and demonstrated that customers' nostalgia varied from each individual and that each could have nostalgic feelings towards multiple brands, which I thought would be pretty much a given, but this scale actually measures these variables. So why is this relevant to Westgirls? So I'll list a few references that you may be familiar with and may trigger those nostalgic feels. Clueless. Also, side note, I literally bought a Jeep that looks like Cher's, which is pretty cool. Also, Tamagotchis, Mr. Bean, United Colors of Benetton. So that's a European clothing brand, which is very popular there and was definitely very popular back in the 2000s. The sealed sections in Girlfriend magazine. Yep, we've all been there if you were a millennial Aussie. Video hits, lemon ruskies. So shout out to my friend Alla, who used to basically intravenously inject these. The OC, Tyra Banks, paranormal shows on Foxtel, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is, sorry, the best show of all time, and The Sims, just to name a few. My own personal example of nostalgia and products to suck me into buy would probably be Woolies Mud Cakes. So you'll have to tell me what yours would be. And there's also a proper way to use nostalgia, especially within literature. There needs to be some form of historical aspect for the references to be successful and not cringe. The best way for me to describe this is to give an example. So trends obviously are something that, you know, come into fashion and then go out of fashion. And for a very specific example, if a book used the phrase on fleek, which was a slang word that was popular, or a slang term that was popular in the 2010s, if they used that in a book that was then published in 2011, that terminology would come across as cringeworthy and not actually nostalgic. Whereas Westgirls uses references in a successful way because they have waited for enough time to use them for them not to be cringe, and now they're nostalgic to the audience, making the readers feel positive feelings towards these references and making them want to read further and dive into what's actually happening. Nostalgia, once believed to be a debilitating condition, now serves as a potent advertising force to sell products, as well as a very tactful literary device if used properly. Luna's Journey mirrors this broader global modeling standards, where physical appearance and nostalgia are wielded as powerful tools to sell products and foster connections with consumers. She provides a thought-provoking explanation of racial passing and its implications. Her actions are problematic, but they shed light on the complexities of beauty, privilege, and identity. The narrative does raise questions about the impact of physical appearance on success, the ethics of racial passing when you are a white person, and the enduring power of nostalgia in shaping our perceptions and choices. Beauty remains a subjective and multifaceted concept, and Westgirls provides a window into this interplay of factors that influence our understanding of it. I hope that you've enjoyed this episode, because that's all I have time for. If you've learned something new, please remember to subscribe to the podcast and rate and review if you haven't already. Our Instagram is in the description box for even more refreshing content. In the next episode, we'll be exploring the thriller The Push by Ashley Audrain. And if you weren't already scared of having a child, then this will definitely do it for you. Stay juicy, and I look forward to chatting to you next time. Bye!